Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio had its first reported case of measles in more than 2 years this month. That's amid a nationwide outbreak of the disease. Dr. Walter Orenstein is a professor and associate director with the Emory Vaccine Center in Atlanta, former president of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Ohio, a populous state, a big state, granted for, by some people's estimations, a flyover state, but also a big drive-through state, is just reporting its first confirmed case. And I made sure I double-checked with my producer on that, the first confirmed case in 2 years. Why are some states getting these outbreaks and others, like Ohio, nothing?
Well, I think it all depends on what the underlying immunization status is of the population and whether people with measles are traveling in those areas. A major problem we're seeing in the United States this year is clusters of unvaccinated children that are susceptible to developing and sustaining an outbreak. In Ohio, I don't know what the status is, but there is likely to be clusters of unvaccinated children, and those are the ones we need to be most concerned about.
The question is then if those clusters are moving around and spreading it.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Moving, the clusters can move around and spread it. Measles, in order to sustain itself, people with infection have to find susceptible people and transmit, and they in turn transmit to others. If the transmitters don't find susceptibles, the chains are broken. And so the hope is, in Ohio and other places, that transmitting cases aren't going to find these kinds of clusters of unvaccinated individuals.
People give a lot of different reasons for why they don't get their kids vaccinated anymore. But for some people, it's like with the flu shots. They're saying it just doesn't seem to make – what difference does it make if I don't vaccinate my kids, if I don't get the flu shot or the measles vaccine?
Measles is not a trivial disease. Fevers often get as high as 103 to 105 degrees Fahrenheit. About 7 to 9% of kids with measles get ear infections. 1 to 6% develop pneumonia. About 8% get diarrhea, and also about 1 to 4 per 1,000 or 2,000 cases get brain inflammation, which often leads to brain damage. About 1 to 3 individuals per 1,000 cases of measles actually dies from measles, even in countries like the United States. The preliminary data we have from CDC early on in this outbreak is about 9% of the cases were hospitalized. It is not a trivial disease.
The anti-vax movement has been, even though it seems to be growing in certain places, certainly the reasoning behind it has been largely debunked. Nobody, it's science has shown that the fears are unwarranted. What do you make of the enduring opposition?
I think that's a very, very critical question. I think part of it is the circulation of conspiracy theories, the lack of trust, what is circulating on the internet giving false information. I think it's critical that people who have questions talk with their doctor. I think one thing we need to realize is hesitant parents are not necessarily bad parents. Mm-hmm. They're trying to look out for what is best for their child. I think the important thing is they're getting to an information source who has the science, who has the knowledge, and can speak with them and answer their questions. And that's why pediatricians, family physicians, those are the people who can be most helpful to a parent who has some concerns. But the bottom line is the overwhelming scientific information show that the benefits of measles-containing vaccines far, far, far exceed the risks.
Iris in North Linden, you're on the air with Dr. Walter Orenstein, professor and associate director with the Emory Vaccine Center in Atlanta. Hi, Iris.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you.
Hello.
I have a question. My aunt and my mother were both pregnant during the early 1960s outbreak of measles. My aunt miscarried. My brother is deaf. I do know that there is a correlation between in utero exposure to all types of measles and birth defects. Have you noted an increase in reported birth defects in the areas of the country that have been exposed to measles? I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Iris. And the period that she's referring to, Dr. Orenstein, is a pre-vaccination period, right?
Well, I think she's saying both.
Okay.
Is it happening now?
Okay.
First of all, the major problem with birth defects is not measles, it's rubella, which is sometimes called German measles.
Mm-hmm.
The vaccine we give is measles, mumps, rubella. And rubella was a terrible tragedy. About 20,000 kids in the 1964-65 pandemic were severely infected, causing brain damage, deafness, blindness, and many other things. Measles, the measles virus, if it affects a pregnant woman, generally doesn't cause birth defects, but can cause premature labor and all the serious consequences that go with that. I am not aware of potential problems in pregnant women, but the CDC would be in the best position to answer that question. Nevertheless, getting the vaccine protects pregnant women. Pregnant women cannot get vaccinated. They need to be vaccinated before they become pregnant.
Mm.
And again, if they're not exposed to the disease through high levels of immunity in the community, which is often called herd immunity mm-hmm. or community protection, they're indirectly protected by vaccination.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the measles, mumps, and rubella. The vaccination usually is for all three. There was a mumps outbreak here a few years back. Any thoughts about why there hasn't been a rubella outbreak like there was back in the 60s when I did get the German measles, by the way?
Okay, first of all, rubella is less contagious than measles.
Okay.
So that the immunity level to block transmission is lower than measles. Measles is probably at the top of the list of contagious vaccine-preventable diseases. And that's why we recommend we need in every community, throughout the community, about a 95% coverage to feel secure we won't have outbreaks of measles. For rubella, it's lower than that. That's not to say we need to be unconcerned. We need to be concerned, but rubella is easier to prevent, in a sense, than measles. But we need to get people vaccinated against all three diseases and achieve very high coverage rates.
How has the development of vaccines changed since the 60s?
Well, I think what has happened is we have been able, with some of the newer vaccines, to use much more sophisticated molecular techniques. So, for example, our human papillomavirus vaccine, which is a anti-cancer vaccine causing cervical cancer, anal cancer, throat cancer, and many other kinds of cancers, was developed by taking the gene for the surface of the virus, putting it in another organism that produces it, and it forms little particles of that surface gene. It's killed and can induce an immune response. So that's some of the newer techniques that have come out. But the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccines are very safe and effective. They were developed through more traditional techniques in which the wild viruses were passaged in tissue culture, and virulence is not helpful in tissue culture, so they lose the genes for virulence but maintain their genes to reproduce and the surface genes. One of the things people don't know is what is a vaccine and what does it do? A vaccine gives your immune system practice, so it makes it ready to detect the germ, the virus, the bacteria, and destroy it before it can cause disease. if your immune system is unprimed, unlearned, the germ, the virus, the bacteria can overwhelm it. So the vaccine, again, gets your immune system ready to react and destroy the germ before it can cause severe disease.
You mentioned that pregnant women can't get the vaccine. Who else is not able to get the vaccine?
There are a few people. The reason pregnant women is measles, mumps, rubella is what's called a live attenuated or a live weakened vaccine, and we don't recommend it for pregnant women. Although the data we have suggests it is safe, we don't think it's a good idea.
It's not worth the risk, yeah.
It's not worth the risk. Other contraindications are a history of very severe reactions to some of the components, such as neomycin, which is an antibiotic that's in the vaccine, any other components of the vaccine, and particularly people whose immune systems are severely suppressed, such as a child with cancer who's on chemotherapy to suppress their immune system. They can't be protected directly by the vaccine. They shouldn't receive it. They're protected indirectly if they're not exposed. And that's the issue. Vaccines protect in two ways. One, in those who are vaccinated, inducing an active immune response. And for those who can't be vaccinated, by high levels of immunity, herd immunity, mm-hmm. community protection, preventing them from getting exposed to the pathogen, the virus, or the bacteria.
Is there a way to know if an infant would have problems with the components? Are there ways to test for that to avoid that risk taking?
There clearly, if the infant has a history of having had reactions to components, that can be helpful. For an infant with no reactions, there is no real way to test.
Okay.
The reactions are rare. The most common is a low-grade fever, which can occur in about 5 to 15%, and a mild rash in about 5%. This is far more benign than what would happen if you actually got the measles, where you have almost 100% with high fevers and 100% with rash. So there are reactions, but they're generally mild. And these vaccines are covered under our system, and all children who are vaccinated, their parents are required to get what's called important vaccine information statements, which describe the benefits and risks of the vaccines.
You told Wired that measles is an indicator disease. What is meant by that?
Basically, because it is so contagious, and that because you need the highest levels of immunity, if you have problems in your immunization coverage in a community, measles is often the first disease you see. And it should raise concerns that you may also see problems with other diseases if you don't do something in your community to raise immunization coverage.
I think I've been vaccinated. Well, I've had measles, so I don't think I need the vaccination. But for people who haven't been vaccinated, is there ever an age that you're free of free of it? You don't grow out of being susceptible to it.
You don't grow out of it, but we say is people born prior to 1957 almost certainly have been exposed to the wild virus. And so people born prior to 1957 can generally be considered immune. People born after that, for adults, we do recommend at least one dose. And if you're in a high-risk group, such a healthcare worker, if you haven't had it before, at least two doses of vaccine.
Dr. Walter Orenstein, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
Dr. Walter Orenstein is a professor and associate director with the Emory Vaccine Center in Atlanta, and he's former president of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In a chronically sleep-deprived society, feeling tired or burned out might seem like the norm, but profound fatigue can cause physical pain, it may cloud thinking, and interrupt daily function, and it warrants a clinical diagnosis. Dr. Jacob Teitelbaum is an author, doctor of internal medicine, and lead researcher on burnout and chronic fatigue syndrome. Welcome to the show.
Oh, it's good to be with you, Ann.
The International Classification of Diseases ranks burnout as a legitimate medical diagnosis. What's your trajectory for that? I mean, how did it get to that point?
Well, best definition for burnout that I've heard is when your soul grows too big for the role you're playing. And I think people are getting more and more of that. They're realizing that the roles they've been pegged in, they've outgrown them. And that's when it's time to move on to the next stage of one's growth.
And when you talk about one's growth, so this is an emotional thing. You've got to move on, do something different with your life?
It's basically a matter of tuning into how things feel to the person. Our brain will tell us what we were programmed to do as children, but our feelings will tell us what's authentic. So whether it's in your relationships, whether it's in your personal life, whether it's in your professional life, you need to do an assessment every so often. How does this feel? Does it still excite me? Does it still feel good? And if not, what's the next level of growth?
But to make it a legitimate medical diagnosis, how do you do that?
Easy. You get people trying to sell pills or make a profit off of it, and you get them together in the same room, and they do that. I think it should not be under a medical diagnosis myself. I think fibromyalgia, fatigue, pain, these are more legitimate diagnoses. And when it comes to using medications or natural treatments, these are best approached in that way. Diabetes, interestingly enough, is also a reflection of the human energy crisis. All of these are reflections. All of these are very treatable, and all of these are poorly treated by standard medical approaches.
Because they take a pill approach, and you're saying take a lifestyle approach.
A combination. I like to use the best of lifestyle, medications, and natural options. Natural options get a bad rap, sometimes for good reason. But there are thousands of studies. For example, we have a published double-blind placebo-controlled study showing that 90% of people with fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue syndrome can get an average 91% improvement in quality of life by using a comprehensive protocol that uses all of these. But since it's cheap and not patentable, most physicians simply will not hear about the research.
According to the International Classification of Diseases, doctors can diagnose a patient if they meet the following symptoms: feelings of energy depletion or exhaustion, increased mental distance from one's job, and reduced professional efficacy. And again, I was wondering, how in the world do you determine that? It's so subjective.
And I totally agree with you. I think that's a nonsense diagnosis.
So what do we mean? Even is burnout, is fatigue part of burnout? Is everybody who's burned out tired, or can burnout be something different than a physical manifestation of fatigue?
I consider burnout to be a very different process. Okay. It's a matter, again, as I said, when you've outgrown what you're doing and you're no longer getting the joy in life. But much more important, I think, for most people these days, if you have pain, one-third of Americans suffer with chronic pain. And this is part of the energy crisis. When muscles don't have enough energy, they get locked in the shortened position, they trigger pain. Another third will have diabetes, which is part of the energy crisis because insulin is not working to get the sugar into the cells to be burned as energy. And for those of you who have exhaustion coupled with inability to sleep, which is a paradox, also widespread pain or cognitive dysfunction, you have fibromyalgia until proven otherwise. And this is very, very treatable. Unfortunately, most physicians don't really know how to address these. In fact, I'll be giving two lectures, one tonight in Centerville, Ohio at Health Foods Unlimited, and the other one tomorrow in Newark at Mound Builders Country Club. Both of these are at 6 p.m. They're free and open to the public. And we're teaching people how to get pain-free, how to get rid of their fibromyalgia, and also how to address diabetes using the best of natural and prescription therapies.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about burnout today. My guest is Dr. Jacob Teitelbaum. He's an author, doctor of internal medicine, and he's a lead researcher on burnout and chronic fatigue syndrome. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. There's chronic fatigue syndrome, as I mentioned. You were diagnosed with it in medical school. What is it?
Basically, it's an energy crisis where your body is spending more energy than you're able to make, and you trigger a circuit breaker. That circuit breaker is called the hypothalamus. It's an almond-sized control center in the brain that controls sleep, hormones, blood pressure. So when that circuit goes offline, people really will crash and burn. It takes them out of the game entirely. It takes a very different treatment than just day-to-day fatigue will for most people.
And how did you respond? I mean, how did you recover from it?
Well, I had to drop out of medical school. I was paying my own way through medical school. My dad was dead. And basically, I got this nasty viral infection that I called the drop-dead flu. I actually had to drop out of medical school, and it left me homeless and sleeping in parks. And it was interesting, Anne. It's as if the universe put a holistic homeless medical school sign on my park bench. All kinds of different people, physicians, naturopaths, osteopaths, nutritionists, all kinds of folks came by and taught me bits and pieces of what they knew. And if they had a pizza with them, I even ate that day. And I was able to cobble together the information I needed to put together a treatment protocol for myself. And I was able to recover, came back to medical school, got my honors in medicine, actually published my first paper while I was a medical student. And I spent the last 45 years researching, publishing studies, writing books, lecturing. That's why I'm on the road now, teaching people how they can recover from this illness. Because unfortunately, for pain, fibromyalgia, and fatigue, physicians' training is nothing short of dismal.
What kind of response do you get from physicians about your point of view on this issue?
Usually, if I'm talking about things that include natural remedies, a lot of doctors will come up and say, "What's that nonsense?" And I say, "I'm glad you asked," and I give them a stack of studies. 90% will throw them in the trash and say, "I don't have time to look at that nonsense." 10%, though, will actually look at the studies and come back and say, "Why didn't anybody teach me about this? What else do you have?" Those who go deeper and deeper into the research end up being called holistic physicians because they're doing more than just what the drug company PR agencies are selling at our conferences and such. So that area is growing very, very rapidly as doctors who look at the research apply it to help their people. And it's a funny thing. The editor of the New England Journal of Medicine basically, you know, says that virtually all of our continuing medical education is slick advertising masquerading as science. It's basically spoon-fed us by the drug companies. Look at our conferences. They're all paid for by the drug companies. So are the speakers on the podium. And there's so much more out there than the newest, most expensive medication. Only 2% of new medications are actually improvements. But doctors will use, and they're well-meaning, we just don't know better. We will use whatever is the most profitable, expensive medication because that's what we're being taught about. And there's so much more that can help people.
What do you think helped you? Was it a combination of things that helped you recover from chronic fatigue syndrome?
I had a heavy-duty sweet tooth, and I had overgrowth of a fungal infection called Candida.
Uh-huh.
It will trigger, most people have chronic sinusitis and nasal congestion combined with irritable bowel syndrome will have that. I also had exhaustion of my adrenal gland, plus a host of nutritional deficiencies. For me, those three were the big ones that helped me to recover. But there are literally hundreds of different factors. I have the U.S. patent for a computerized doctor that they made for people with fibromyalgia. It's a free online quiz they can do that'll analyze their symptoms, their blood tests, determine what's causing their energy drain and how to address it and fix it.
What's the difference between burnout and something like chronic fatigue syndrome?
Totally different things. Chronic fatigue syndrome triggers a widespread malfunction of multiple systems in the body, including the immune system, the autonomic system, widespread muscle shortening. And as I said at the beginning, burnout is just when the life we're living is too small for who we've become.
Burnout, sleep deprivation, and other forms of fatigue like that, for many people it goes undiagnosed. How should someone kind of... what's a checkoff list for people to figure out, you know, to suss out what it is?
Well, if you go to our website at vitality101.com, there's a free quiz that will tell people if they have CFS or fibromyalgia. So that takes 2 minutes, and you'll know right away if that's what's going on in your case. Burnout, matter of are you happy with what you're doing. Fibromyalgia and fatigue, you don't have the energy to do what you want to do. Burnout, you have the energy. You just hate what you're doing.
Well,
not rocket science.
Well, Dr. Teitelbaum, I want to thank you for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
And always a pleasure.
It's Dr. Jacob Teitelbaum. He is an author, doctor of internal medicine, and a researcher on burnout and chronic fatigue syndrome. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Cueing up some tunes during short, intense workouts may change how you feel about the exercise. That's according to a new study published in the journal Psychology of Sport and Exercise that found listening to music can encourage us to push ourselves harder. Gretchen Reynolds is a columnist for the New York Times Well blog. She recently wrote about the issue. Welcome, Gretchen.
Thanks very much for having me.
So, I mean, any kind of boot camp I do, anything like that is always, music's a really big part of it. I tend to wear earplugs, but because it's too loud, but it does help.
There's actually a lot of science that suggests that, yes, it helps to listen to music, but we've known a whole lot less about why and about whether it's music or whether it's listening to other things like books on tape or podcasts, and whether it's just because it distracts you from what's going on in your body, or whether somehow your body itself almost pays attention to the music, so your heart rate might speed up to track to the music. And so one of the things that scientists wanted to do in this study was try to figure out whether it is music that matters, whether it's just a distraction that matters, and whether this kind of music or distraction helps if you're new to exercise. And this was actually a study looking at people who were sedentary, who did not work out much, if at all. And they asked them to do high-intensity interval training, which is a pretty intense form of exercise.
Mm-hmm. And
if you're talking boot camp, it's like that. It's,
right.
It's basically going very hard for about 30 seconds, then resting, then going very hard. And what they found was, yes, music did make a really significant difference. They had people listen to very upbeat music. It's Macklemore, Calvin Harris. they might not be on your playlist, but they're very upbeat with a strong, fast tempo. And they also had them on a separate session, listen to a podcast. And frankly, it sounds like a slightly boring podcast about consumer behavior. But yes, the idea was, is it enough to just have this thing playing in the background that you can listen to? And what they found was that only music really changed not only how people felt about this exercise, but literally how their bodies responded to it. They said afterwards that they had enjoyed the exercise the most. They didn't necessarily say they enjoyed the exercise, period, but they had enjoyed this hard exercise the most when there was this upbeat music playing in the background. And it also turned out that they had worked harder. They were all using stationary bicycles, and it turned out that almost all of them pedaled harder, and their heart rates were higher during the workout when they were listening to music, but they didn't feel as if they were working any harder. Every one of their sessions felt the same to them, but they were burning more calories, they were working harder when this upbeat music was playing in the background, and they were enjoying it more.
Did they... I'm sorry.
That was not true when they listened to the podcast.
Yeah, the options were upbeat, high energy music and a podcast.
And then they did one with just nothing going on in the background as a control. And so there were three sessions.
And were they working out together?
They were working out, yes, in a university gym. So they were all doing the same session. And the music was chosen, actually, by a separate group of people who were asked to pick, which of these songs do you think is the most inspiring or would be the most inspiring during exercise? So it was music that was designed to make people feel, you know, peppy, happy, whatever. It wasn't music that the people had chosen. But what I found interesting and what the scientists found interesting was it did look like this phenomenon occurred that they call entrainment, which is basically that your body itself tunes into the exercise. And they were working harder, essentially in rhythm with the exercise.
That's what I was going to say.
Without knowing it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, when even in my boot camp, when we're moving around and doing different things, I do find myself, it helps if I can just get into the rhythm of whatever the music is, and it pushes me.
It does, and that's one reason to, first of all, consider listening to music, which I listen to music when I'm doing a hard workout. I actually listen to books on tape, to Audible, when I'm going for a long, easy run. And that really makes sense in terms of this research, which is these were short, hard workouts, and the music really did help people work out a little harder, but also enjoy it more. Hmm. If you're going for a longer, slower, maybe easier workout, you might want to distract yourself. And in that case, this wasn't part of the exercise, but there's other research suggesting that listening to books, listening to podcasts may be the perfect choice in that situation.
Any sense about, or were any questions asked about the group versus exercising alone piece of this?
No, although that obviously is very important. And there's some pretty good evidence that especially for people who are somewhat reluctant to exercise or new to exercise, it can help to be part of a group. It provides motivation. It also sort of often gets rid of excuses. People often do, in fact, work out a little bit harder when they're with other people, particularly when there are men there. men tend to start competing with one another, whether they're supposed to or not.
Mm-hmm.
But there's pretty good evidence that the social element of exercise can also be an important motivator. So if you want to find ways to make sure that you show up at the gym, load some music on your iPod and ask a friend to come with you.
All right. So here's the other side of this coin, another side. It's many sided coin, I suppose. Why we don't lose weight when we exercise. I really ramped up in January with this boot camp and yoga, and I have only lost a few pounds, which is fine. I've lost a lot of inches. I mean, I feel better and I look better. But what is it about the weight thing and exercise?
Well, this is probably one of the biggest issues in exercise science and exercise behavior and in the lives of those of us who exercise. The most common question that I personally get as someone who covers exercise is, how come I'm exercising and I'm not getting skinnier? So it is a question that matters to all of us. And the fact is, study after study and personal experience after personal experience suggests that very few people lose weight if all their entire exercise or their entire weight loss program is exercise. And there are a lot of theories about why that is. And the primary ones are people either start moving less on the days when they exercise, so they're actually not burning a lot more calories.
They're prepping, getting ready to exercise.
Or they just don't even know they're doing it. Their bodies just say, fit more, and they do. Or that they're eating more without realizing it, which is probably also true.
Mm-hmm.
And so the study that I wrote about really wanted to try to quantify what went on when people started a new exercise program that was designed to help them to lose weight. And so they had a big group of people, and this was a 6-month-long study, which is pretty lengthy, and they had some of them do exercise 3 times a week that resulted in about 700 calories a week of additional energy expenditure, which is probably about 1/2 hour of exercise most days. The other group did about, more than double that for about 1,700 calories a week, which is at least 1 hour a day of exercise. And they didn't change any their diets. They said, eat what you want. They had them wear activity monitors and do all sorts of other tests to track whether their metabolisms changed, whether they were eating more, whether they were sitting less or sitting more. And after 6 months, almost none of them had lost as much weight as they had wanted to or as people had expected them to. And it turned out that it was not because they were sitting more, that there were no changes in how active they were apart from exercise, but almost all of them were eating more. And they were eating a lot more. That's both the interesting and slightly discouraging part of this study. They were only eating about 100 calories more a day than would they should have, really.
Mm-hmm.
But that was enough to undercut their weight loss. And the lead scientist said that's the equivalent of 4 bites of food, essentially.
Yeah.
And so the real lesson of this is, first, exercise really does not burn that many calories. Most of us think it burns a lot more than it does. And so people will go out for a 1/2 hour walk and then have a cookie. You've just taken in 100 calories more than you burned.
Mm-hmm.
And so the reality is, for weight loss, exercise is not very effective, and you have to control what you eat. You just have to watch the calories that you're taking in. But exercise has so many other advantages.
We can't. Yeah, I mean the bone density, muscle flexibility goes on.
Everything, and it's also just essential for keeping weight off once you have lost it. There's a big registry, the weight loss registry, that includes people who have lost weight and kept it off, and those who maintain weight loss for at least a year invariably exercise. So it's extremely important for all sorts of other reasons, but it's not your best route to losing weight.
It's just your best route to keeping the weight off once you've lost it.
And being healthy and living longer, right, and being happier and all those other things.
So many things.
But the fact is, many people start exercising in hopes that it will make them thin. And when it does not immediately, many of them stop. And that's a shame. So I think it is an important message that exercise is extremely important for all sorts of things in your life. It will help you lose weight. It will certainly help you to keep weight off,
mm-hmm,
but you do have to control your diet.
Gut bacteria, a common topic on Wellness Wednesday these days. Could a gut bacteria supplement make us run faster? You wrote about another new study that found bacteria from the intestines of athletes might help inactive people exercise more easily. I've heard about transferring gut bacteria. Is that what they did?
Well, yes, although they didn't transfer it to people yet. as you mentioned, the gut microbiome is a very, very popular area of study and interest right now. And there's quite a bit of evidence that one of the other things exercise does for you is change your gut. If you exercise regularly, you start having different bacteria living in your intestines than if you don't. And it hasn't been completely clear what that means. Are those gut bugs particularly good for you? Would they be good for other people? Would they help other people to lose weight, exercise, all the good things associated with being in shape?
Mm-hmm.
And so this study looked at a group of Boston Marathon runners who, you know, obviously are in shape, exercise a lot. And they looked at their gut microbiome right before and right after the race, the Boston Marathon itself, which meant the researchers were showing up at racers' houses every day and,
wow,
gathering samples of their stool.
Mm-hmm.
The wonders of being a scientist.
Right, yeah.
But then they looked at essentially changes in the microbiome immediately after the race, and they found one really substantial difference, that there was one type of microbe that was much more common after the race and was also more common in the racers just in general, that they had more of it than most people do before the race, and they had a lot more of it after the race. And it turned out that this particular microbe also lives on lactic acid, which your muscles produce when you are exercising. And lactic acid is not a toxin or nasty byproduct, which a lot of people think. It's a kind of bodily fuel.
Mm-hmm.
And these microbes were living on a form of lactic acid. And so the researchers thought maybe this is one of the key aspects of how your microbiome changes with exercise, as you get more of this microbe. So they gave that microbe to some mice. They essentially infused it into them. And those mice did become able to run longer before they got really tired. And so the possible message is this might be a microbe that if people who are out of shape had more of it, maybe exercise might feel easier for them. We don't know if that's true. It hasn't been tested. There's no clear understanding of how that would work, but it's what these scientists are now looking into, is would this help? They're not so much interested in would it make people who are already runners run longer.
Mm-hmm.
Could it maybe help people who find exercise difficult find it a little easier?
Give them a jump start, help jumpstart them into it.
It's an interesting idea. I think there's a long ways to go before anyone should start, you know, looking for fecal transplants from runners to help them. But it's certainly an interesting area of study, and it does sort of point out how different your body becomes when you exercise frequently. I mean, almost everything changes, including the microbes that you have inside your intestines.
I think it's fascinating, though, the question of what people get out of exercising, what they walk away from, and what motivates them to turn around and walk back and do it all over again the next day or every other day or whenever their routine is, and how some people just drop out. Something is missing.
Yes, and that's actually probably the most important area of scientific research, and one that we're not making a huge amount of progress on, is what does motivate people and why some people, as you said, they will start and then stop. And the interesting thing is the science that we do have on that topic almost all points to the simple message of you have to be enjoying it. It has to be fun. It can't be because your husband said you should do it. It can't be because you think it might even be good for your heart. It really does seem to require that you like it. And that brings us back to the discussion of music. For a lot of people, that seems to make it more enjoyable. I would say try that. Try finding someone you like working out with. If it turns out you don't like jogging, stop jogging. Try walking. Try a swim. Go to a Zumba class. There usually is some form of movement that most people will enjoy. You just have to find it. And that's the only thing that will make people stick with workouts.
I've found that I need the camaraderie and someone to eye roll with and groan with. and all of this said, because we continue to look for the anti-aging pill, and a new report found that a popular diabetes drug, metformin, may hurt some of the health benefits of aerobic exercise in healthy older adults. So not so much, right?
The one thing we can say is there really is no replacement for exercise in a pill. And people, metformin is a drug that a lot of people are on now. It is very effective as a way to treat type 2 diabetes. And the study that I wrote about had nothing to do with whether people should stop taking metformin for type 2 diabetes. What is happening is some physicians and a lot of individuals are prescribing or asking for metformin, that they're perfectly healthy, but they're taking it in hopes that it will slow the aging process. It does seem to do that in worms. So, of course, you make the leap to, yes, it'll help us. Exercise also is very effective as a way to sort of change the arc of aging. It changes the cellular effects of aging. And so there were some people who thought, okay, let's take metformin and exercise and never grow old at all. That is not what appears to happen. It looks like if you take metformin, just because of the cellular actions that that drug has, you do not get as fit. You actually do not gain as much fitness. And you don't get some of the health benefits, including better insulin reactivity from exercise. Metformin seems to actually undo some of the effects of exercise. So if someone is taking, a healthy person is or plans to take metformin to slow aging, the message of this study would be talk very carefully with your doctor, because the single best way to age well is to be in shape. And it looks like metformin may blunt that.
Gretchen Reynolds, thank you so much. Appreciate your time as always.
Thanks very much for having me.
Gretchen Reynolds, she's a columnist for the New York Times Well blog. That's it for Wellness Wednesday. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.